Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's start out with something really unattended and kind of crazy. I remember reading a science fiction story about a very expensive drug that was essentially an aphrodisiac, and it made you feel just wonderful. And it also made you gain weight, but people didn't care. Everyone just kind of went with it because the drug was so compelling. Well, I'm going to flip that story around and talk about the drug that makes you lose weight, which is the GLP-1 inhibitors, and how these drugs are, just turning out to have all kinds of unintended consequences that really are just reshaping the way that we're thinking about addiction. So let's give you a story first. This is a woman named Susan Aiken, and she first started injecting, I think she was doing Zepbound earlier this year while she was in rehab for alcohol and cocaine addiction. And she found that the cravings that she had, the calling out from these substances, muted down quite a bit. It dulled her urges. And when she came across a trigger, well, the trigger didn't have the power. She could eat sugar and not think about cocaine. She could smell alcohol on someone's breath without thinking about alcohol. And the drug that she was injecting was Zepbound, one of the GLP-1 drugs. And it is not approved, 100% not approved for behavioral health. But doctors are already doing what doctors do, which is going after off-label uses. And in this case, expensive private rehab centers as well as not-for-profit centers are doing exactly that. They're using the drug, either buying the actual drug or using the compounded agents, which tend to work fairly well, not perhaps quite as consistently, because of course it's homebrew, but pretty good. Addiction specialists say these medications act to quell addictive behaviors, and we've known clinical trials have also showed, and I've covered this on the program, that semaglutide, which is the active ingredient in Ozempic and Wegovy, can reduce the risk of heart attacks and treat liver disease. And these drugs, of course, mimic GLP-1, which is a natural hormone that boosts insulin production, curbs appetite, and slows stomach emptying. So, of course, they're used for obesity. Tirzepatide, which is in Zepbound, also has an additional hormone mimicking effect that enhances insulin release and amplifies the appetite suppression. But we don't really understand how it works. And because of the addiction responses that we're seeing, it's being postulated that perhaps it has an effect on the dopamine reward loop. The medications appear to be turning down the gain on reward circuitry in the brain, says Kyle Simmons, a professor of pharmacology and physiology at Oklahoma State University. But this has ushered in a wave of research. The VA is looking at these drugs to help veterans with moderate to severe drinking problems, help diabetic patients who smoke, and people addicted to opioids. And there's federally backed studies of patient records that were released that show that GLP-1 use in patients who are diabetic or obese has reduce the risk of alcohol abuse, cannabis use disorder, and opiate overdoses. And this is medical records, so this is not, these are just like, oh, they're on this drug, and oh, look, the rates of these things have actually gone down in people on this drug. So we consider that epidemiology retrospective research. But there are some prospective things. Just published last February in JAMA Psychiatry, researchers found that problem drinkers who got a weekly semaglutide injection drank less and had fewer cravings for alcohol and cigarettes compared to placebo, which is, of course, what we want, prospective placebo studies. The NIH, Institute on Drug Abuse, are running separate double-blind clinical trials looking at alcohol cravings. And researchers are also charting brain activity using functional MRI to see how participants respond when exposed to alcohol cues, and using virtual reality headsets to measure how they respond to images of food. A spokesman for Eli Lilly, which manufactures Zepbound, said the company is considering clinical trials to assess the drug as a treatment for substance abuse disorders. All I can say, parenthetically, is if it gets an FDA approval for that, I don't think there'll be many people left who aren't taking it. In fact, a lot of people are using it in microdoses because there's been some buzz about it promoting longevity and general wellness. There isn't really much evidence for microdosing on these agents, I want to emphasize. And I think microdosing is sort of the fad drug diet of our era. If GLP is effective, however, it might, if it works for alcohol and it works for drugs, what about gambling addiction and other compulsive behaviors? It's really overwhelming, the number of people who died of drug overdoses last year, 80,000, and about 48 million Americans have some sort of substance abuse disorder. So if we could treat that, well, just think about it. It's really amazing. Another anecdote is Stephen Klein, a physician who specializes in addiction at Carone, which is a high-end rehab center in Pennsylvania, Atlanta, and Delray Beach. So he spearheads a pilot program that's prescribed GLP-1 to more than 130 patients. And he's also partnered with Open Doors, a nonprofit in Rhode Island that helps formerly incarcerated women reenter society. And they are offering GLP-1 through their recovery program using the generic version. And again, people are testifying, I guess that's as good a word as any, they're testifying about their experiences and how it's helping them. So one patient who has been using it at the Open Doors clinic says it's an essential drug, just like insulin for me. So we'll have to see where this goes, but because of the cost of these agents, there's been a substantial increase in both Medicare and Medicaid costs just to cover the cost of these agents for people who meet the criteria, that is to say diabetes or obesity, to receive them. So what's going to happen to our healthcare system if we don't take control of drug prices as more and more amazing, miraculous even, pharmaceuticals get developed, and we haven't even talked about some of the agents coming out for cancer. We're just going to do a short little story now. So scientists studied twins diets, and what they found was that Let me tell you. Two twins, Alexandra Chai and her daughter Mariah Foster Chai, were identical twins, and they participated in a study to examine the different effects of diet. It's a Stanford study, and they randomly gave them slips of paper that said either which diet they would follow, omnivore or vegan. So while her sister got to eat a diet of meat and vegetables, Shai Chai had to give up her bacon, sushi, and steak and eat tofu, beans, and vegetables. She didn't love the diet, but when her blood tests came back, she was actually really surprised. After examining 22 pairs of identical twins, researchers found that vegan eaters had substantially lower cholesterol, lower insulin, and lower body weight than their twin who followed the meat diet for not a very long time. Several months only. Vegans' low-density lipoprotein dropped by 15 milligrams in 8 weeks. Vegan aiders shed about 4 pounds more, and their insulin dropped by 20%. And by using twins, we can establish the difference between what is genetic, what is innate, shall we say, innate to the environmental change, to be clear. Well, for the last 20 years, you've probably heard at least one or two news stories about the decline of frog species across the world. And in particular, one of the places where there are the most frogs naturally is Central America. And across Central America, scientists have been watching with, well, mini thought balloons full of mini question marks over their head as frog populations have declined drastically. And with fewer tadpoles to eat all that mosquito larvae in the water, the rates of mosquito-borne malaria in Central America have climbed, resulting in a 500% increase in some areas. It's one of the pieces of the emerging area of research in which ecologists and economists are trying to actually calculate the costs of species decline. And just as I like to say to my patients, you are an ecosystem. You have bacteria living in you and on you and all sorts of things that contribute to your body in diverse ways. Well, the actual ecosystems are, there's a lot of stuff going on under the radar. And many plants and animals, wolves, bats, birds, trees, are actually fundamental to human well-being. Nobody really knew why the frogs were disappearing. Some paper published in Texas, herpetologists thought that egrets were eating them. And in Connecticut, people said it was the raccoons. And in Brazil, they said, well, it's been cold lately. But starting in the early 90s, it was clear that something widespread but invisible was behind the decline. And besides which, it was like a moving wave, which suggested that there was some kind of disease or some kind of environmental factor. We come to Karen Lips, who's one of the discoverers of the actual cause, and she describes being down in Panama in 1993. She would go down every year to study these toads, and she went down to where the toads normally were, and she couldn't find any toads. And then she remembered a related toad species that she had heard had disappeared about 200 miles to the north. So she thought, maybe there's this wave. I think I'll go south. So she went east and south into a cloud forest. And she noticed, and she started studying frogs there. And then she noticed that the frogs were getting really lethargic and tired. They'd make one jump, and it would be their last bout of energy. They'd make a big jump to try to escape, and then they couldn't move anymore, and they'd just die. After she helped publish a photo of the infections on the frog skin, there were herpetologists in Australia looking at wild frogs, and others studying captive ones at the National Zoo, and they realized they were all dealing with the same disease, a fungus that would later be named Batrachochirytrium dendrobatidis. Let's call it BD for short. And it's thought that BD originated in Asia or Africa, where it's widespread. It may have hitched a ride on ships or planes. It now coats every continent except Antarctica. It is really gross. The microscopic pathogen kills by burrowing into the animal's sensitive skin, blocking electrolytes, and therefore sapping muscles of their strength. No calcium in and out, no muscle contraction. And eventually the infected frog becomes so fatigued and loses its gradients that its heart stops for lack of these electrolyte gradients. Well, a bunch of people got a bunch of frogs out of Panama and Central America, and the idea was to rescue them and reestablish them. That's trying to happen. Meanwhile, in the areas where the frogs have dropped, there's been a cascade, right? We talked about no tadpoles to eat the mosquito larvae, but also algae growing and killing the fish because it uses up all the oxygen in the water, and there's no tadpoles to eat the algae. And snake populations dropped because there are fewer adult frogs to eat. So it was a food chain collapse. And that's one of the things about ecosystems. They have food chains. And again, they saw a very striking correlation between the spike in malaria cases after the fungus arrived and the frogs died. You know, we know about ecosystem services. Bees pollinate crops. Trees suck carbon dioxide out of the air. Coral reefs guard coastal communities and foster fish for food. But we're beginning to have a movement emerging that's called One Health, just to sort of frame it for us foolish humans that the health of the ecosystem is fundamental to our health. Other examples abound. Researchers have shown that the collapse of insect-eating bat populations in the United States prompted farmers to use more pesticide on crops, which led to higher human infant mortality rates, documented fact. In the Great Lakes, this is a positive one, the reemergence of gray wolves has had the surprising effect of lowering traffic accidents. See, the wolves prowl along the roads while hunting, which spook the deer and keep them from crossing the road and reducing collisions with cars. In North America, there's something called the emerald ash borer. It's devastated ash trees, which has taken away shade and led to an increase in cardiovascular and respiratory deaths in the areas affected. And in India, there was the most astonishing breakdown. After the vultures experienced a mass die-off, they stopped scavenging, and the meat that needed to be scavenged piled up, and packs of feral dogs moved in and took the place of the vultures, which led to a rise in human deaths from rabies. So I guess the point is maintaining our external and our internal ecosystems are critical. Critical to maintaining our health and the health of the next generation. So it isn't just, oh, we'll survive global warming, you know, we'll go north, we'll go inland, whatever you think you're going to do. It's not going to work because the changes in the environment will have serious impacts on everything. And I think when I think about, you know, a collapse of the food chain, that's really the one that keeps me up at night, because it will not go well. Well, let's turn to something a little more positive. How about listening to music? There's a lot of music on this station, and we want to... let me take a moment, actually, before I launch into this story, since it's about music. And let me just put out a thank you to all of the listeners who donated during our recent pledge drive, or who continue to donate throughout the year by giving us a monthly donation. It's enormously important to the station. It warms my heart to see the number of generous people. And I know if you have contributed that you feel a sense of comradeship and belonging to the station. And that's one of the things that public radio does, is it makes you part of Team Squid. And so to all of those new members of Team Squid, as well as those continuing members who donated, thank you. There was a study published in October, and it's kind of, it's a little double-edged discussion here. They looked at data spanning a decade and involving more than 10,000 relatively healthy people aged 70 or older in Australia. And they asked them if they listened to music or played music most days. And what they found was that those who said yes had a 39% lower rate of dementia than those who did not regularly listen to music. They didn't really specify what kind of music. They didn't really, they did differentiate whether people played music or whether they listened. And they actually found a slightly better result in decreasing general cognitive decline in those who listened rather than performed. But this is an observational study. And the problem with this is that it is a correlation. It does not give us cause and effect. And so just to be play devil's advocate a little bit for the moment, people who are experiencing general cognitive decline at its early stages tend to have a loss of initiative. They're probably less, a little bit less likely to go put a disc in their CD player or turn on the radio or ask whatever their music app is to play the music. There's a certain apathy that happens with mild cognitive decline that I observe in patients who come in complaining of memory issues. And indeed, they've started to drop their outside interests. And it's just a part of this. So it may be that the mild dementia is causing the decline in music listening. On the other hand, there is good research that music does change the brain. At Princeton University Music Cognition Lab, researchers have conducted lots of studies using functional MRI to see what happens to people's brains when they listen to music. And as you would think, they've found that various parts of the brain are activated, including motor areas, you know, tapping your foot, sensory areas, of course, and regions that process emotions, and those involved in imagining or daydreaming. And the important thing, according to Elizabeth Margulis, the director of the Princeton University's Musical Cognition Lab, is that getting all of those different parts of the brain to talk to each other in meaningful ways does good things to fight dementia. There's a substantial amount of data on dementia and music, and especially practicing difficult music or learning a new instrument. These seem to be some of the most, I would say, solid bits of data in the research, because we can measure actual increases in the gray matter in the brain for people who begin taking music lessons, even if they never get very good at it. Also, of course, memory is absolutely stimulated by music, particularly music from your childhood, but also perhaps the song you played at your wedding, or the music that was sort of in the background of a particularly challenging time in your life. So we also know that musical memory doesn't live in the hippocampus. And I shouldn't really say that any memory lives in the hippocampus, because actually the hippocampus is like an old-fashioned switchboard with lots of sockets and plugs, and the person taking the call would, in the old movies, you've probably seen it, pull the plug out and plug it into the place that the person wanted to go. And of course, that telephone exchange was a very small town sort of thing, and not that many people had phones. It was automated very early, probably mostly completely automated, I would say, by the early 1950s, although you still had to use the operator to make a quote-unquote long-distance call. I don't even think there are operators anymore. I haven't talked to one in a very, very long time, but I digress. When people have Alzheimer's or other types of deep cognitive decline, one of the things that is intact, remains intact, is their musical memory. It's in a different place. It doesn't depend on that hippocampus switchboard to locate the memory. And I'll share a personal recollection. My mother had dementia in her late 80s, and I would play operas for her because she had been an opera singer in her youth, and I could see her, you know, sort of singing to herself, and her mouth was forming the words in Italian, which she didn't speak, or French or German, of any of the songs that she learned back in, she would have learned them back in 1951, and this was in 2014, and there wasn't a lot of memory left, but that music memory for lyrics and music and the tunes, it was there. And I think that itself is good evidence that music is a good, whether it guards you against dementia or whether that's a mirage, music is a wonderful way to enhance your cognitive experience. I see we have a caller coming in, so I'm going to pick that up. Hello, this is Dr. Motika. You're on the air.
Hello, doctor.
Hello.
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 Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. When I was about 12 years old, my mother let me tear apart her console TV with stereo and AM/FM radio, and I stuck the AM/FM radio underneath my bed, and I listened to FM all night long.
Yes.
And it was a good thing.
What?
Then,
go ahead.
Let's say when I was 14 on up to about 18 or 19, they had dances at the Santa Cruz Civic on Friday and the Coconut Grove on Saturday.
Wow.
And I would go to those all the time. So that was physically stimulating, auditory stimulation, and then the smells of the girls and then just the interaction with everybody. It's a completely different world from that now. Completely.
What do you think is the major difference?
The fact that we aren't engaging our senses as much as they did before. Like, you know, so many people are on Call of Duty. That's your fingers working and your brain thinking about it. You're going to go kill this guy or something along those lines. And I like the aspect of music, playing music, listening to music, and participating in body movement relative to listening to the music. What would a group of people that they turn as they listen to music? Not whirling dervishes, but anyway. So they've got something in their society that I believe lets them experience things that somebody on the computer all day doesn't experience.
I think you're right, of course. I agree.
And by engaging with people and people from different societies, we get more and more information. Like I, when I go on a call for, you know, ordering a product or whatever, and I'll get to chat with the person helping me, and I would say, what is your favorite meal that your mother used to make you when you were a child? So it goes back into those sensory things of good times, it tasted really good, I felt good after eating, and so many different societies give us different foods, and I think we miss that when we keep people away.
Let me ask you something.
Yes.
What was that favorite meal that your mother made when you were growing up?
Well, she made all kinds of good meals, but she used to make me over easy eggs, and she would take the toast and butter it, and the toast would be buttered from crust to crust. Then she'd cut it into inch-wide strips so that I could pop the egg yolk and just dip that little bit of crust in and get a bite of egg yolk, egg, and buttered toast. And that was a really good one.
And so simple. So,
I know.
So simple, but so perfect, right?
And then a New York steak, rice pilaf, and asparagus. That was another one of my favorite meals.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. That's some lovely thoughts, and you're making me hungry. Any last words?
What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Oh, well, my grandmother made she was from Arkansas, and she had worked as a boarding house cook until she retired. She made the world's best fried chicken. I mean, and so my favorite meal was fried chicken, potato salad. Also, she made the best potato salad, of course. And then she would take Campbell's tomato soup, and she would make a roux. You know, that's a sort of a sauce, like a white sauce. And she would put a lot of pepper in it. And then she'd put that and stir it into the tomato soup with just a little bit of cheese. And I think she usually used probably like Velveeta or something. But oh my God. Oh my God. Ambrosia.
Okay, so that's going to get out over the airwaves, and you don't know how many people you may affect to go, well, what was my favorite meal? And then where can I find that? Where's the recipe?
Yes.
So,
well,
I hope we spread it out.
Let's do that. Thank you again.
Okay.
It was a lovely,
okay,
lovely
bye-bye.
Call. Bye. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hello there. Who are you and where are you calling from?
Okay, this is Gene in Pacific Grove.
Hey, Gene. What can I do for you tonight?
I just wanted to share an experience since the earlier stuff you talked about was rather interesting. I have a disease that has a name.
Okay.
Grover's disease.
Oh my! Now it sounds vaguely familiar, but I'm going to have to resort to Google because I don't really remember.
No, I'll tell you what it is.
All right, you do that.
Okay, it's itchy skin, and it's named after a doctor who discovered it and said, "We don't know what causes it, and we don't have a cure."
Oh, okay. Well, that's helpful, isn't it?
So my dermatologist she's had, usually I've looked it up on the net, and it can go away in a year. I've had it since before last Christmas when I tried to get hold of my dermatologist and my internist doctor. But anyway, what she came up with, CeraVe and something called clobestasol
propionate. Yes, this is a steroid. This is
so
a steroid.
Anyway, the itchy skin is there, and it doesn't go away. I've had it since before last Christmas. And then my wife said, let's try aloe vera.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been, and aloe vera has been helping. But this is a disease that is a weird disease, and I'm just following up because I listened to your earlier one.
Right.
If you go on the blog and look at it, people have had it for a long time. My dermatologist has one woman who's had it for 20 years.
Well, let me just describe that people get itchy skin and they'll get small red bumps, and sometimes those bumps will be scaly or crusty. And
yes.
It can persist for years. What else do they say about it that's interesting? Typically appears on the chest and back, although I don't know if that's true for you. And they say heat makes it worse. That's
And what makes it worse?
Heat supposedly makes it worse in the sun.
Oh, yes. And I love hot showers.
Well, I'm going to make a functional medicine approach. So when people get weird skin things like this that are fairly widely distributed and itchy, my brain immediately goes to, you have potentially got a food sensitivity where you've made antibodies against something that you eat fairly frequently. And these antibodies are you've just like vaccinated yourself against this food. And I won't go into the mechanisms of leaky gut and blah, blah, blah. But there's a couple things that you could try.
Yep.
And one of them is something called an elimination diet. And briefly, an elimination diet means if you take a look at the standard American diet and if you were to boil it down to like the 9 or 10 most common components of that diet, you stop eating all of them. So this is things like peanuts, oranges, wheat, soy, corn, you know, the GMO all-stars, and a few other things that like shellfish that are particularly antigenic. But in general, you can look up elimination diet. Functional medicine has one. If you send me a letter or an email to my website, askdrdon.com, and hit the contact us and just request an elimination diet, I will send one. Plus, it's a whole bunch. It's like 40 pages of stuff. So it's got why is this diet important? And then it's got recipes and it's got tools for using it. And it's even got a list of things you can go buy at Trader Joe's that would fit with the elimination protocol, which is to avoid these things at least 80% of the time, because you aren't going to be perfect, for a month. And then at the end of the month, you start adding things back one at a time, and you look for a flare of some kind of symptom. It may not even be the same symptom. It could be sinus congestion. It could be abdominal pain. And you're like, well, I didn't get that before. Right, you didn't. And there's a reason why you get a new symptom when this happens, which I'm not going to go into because it's deeply technical. But the point is, there's a whole protocol to this. And you don't just go back to eating normally, because you'll miss the thing that you took out that you need to leave out if you do it that way. So you have to. And if you continue, and with skin takes 60 to 90 days for it to really clear up. So the idea with the elimination diet is to identify the things that are potentially making you sick. And maybe this isn't it, but I wanted to give you this like meaningful, actionable plan, because otherwise it's just massive shrug and steroids. And idiopathic is my favorite definition of idiopathic, which is what Grover's disease or many other things that come to through your doors as a dermatologist. Idiopathics means we're idiots, we doctors, and we don't know the pathology.
I like that.
But give this a shot, because for I'll just say weird skin stuff that's idiopathic as far as the dermatologist is concerned, it's always worth actually doing this elimination diet. It's a bit of a pain in the butt. Don't try it until January. We're heading into Thanksgiving. We just got out of Halloween. Halloween's not that bad, but Thanksgiving and Christmas, forget it. You know.
Yeah, okay.
Forget it.
I know. It started that time last year for me, so I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, and it could be that if you just cut back on certain things and don't eat them all the time. I have terrible heartburn and mouth sores if I start eating chicken all the time. You went, imagine how long that took me to figure out.
Oh, God. I can't.
Because, I mean, that's not even on the elimination diet. So I did one and it didn't work. But the point is, it'll get 80-85% of the food sensitivity related skin things or sinus things or joint pain in particular. That's one you're probably, as I recall, we've called before, I think, you're on the older side of 60. So
yes.
You will likely get joint pain when you do the reintroductions because we all have a little latent arthritis after 60.
My wife just laughed. She's listening to this.
Well, I'm trying to be polite, you know.
Oh, no, that was great. We're in sync.
All right. Well, okay. It's good if she does the elimination diet, too. She may find that she's solved a problem she didn't even know she had.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, you take care. Thank you, and keep listening. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Let's talk about pigs. We've had some animals. We've talked about frogs. Let's talk about pigs. Oh, speaking of which, last night I listened to this absolutely hilarious, we're on music before, it's called Grunt, a Pygorian chant. And it's basically straight up Gregorian chant music, but the pigs are speaking pig Latin, and it comes with this little book, and it's like an entire oratorio with the pigs and the chickens and the cows, but if you listen carefully, you'll realize that the cows are mooing, although what they are is a choir of baritones, and because it's just hilarious. So if you get a chance to listen to it, please do so. You'll get a kick out of it. Okay, so we're talking about growing pigs for their organs. And so these are transgenic pigs. And there are two companies that are doing these. And we've had several fairly public, well-publicized people who got these transplants. And this was just to prove proof of concept. These were people who were very, very sick, end stage, just like the guy who got the pig heart. No one really expected that he could live very long. They were just looking to see if the heart rejected or not. And in this case, they've gotten to the point where they've got about a 50-50 chance on a very small number, so we don't really know what the number is going to shake out. But what we've got is the 10 edit pig. And there's two companies that have made this 10 edit pig. And they've gotten approval to begin full-scale clinical trials on this. And just a few little data. There are millions of people in the world who need kidney transplants, but only about 10% of the people who need one gets one. Even in rich countries, the demand exceeds supply. In America, around 13 people a day die while on waiting lists. And of course, in other countries, hopefully not this one, scarcity feeds a black market. Patients pay tens of thousands of dollars for organs that, well, we hope that they came from a donor, but you can't always be sure when you're, you know, handing out money like that, because it's illegal to accept money to place people on a transplant list or to move them up. How do we get this 10 edit pig? Well, it's basically CRISPR. And even with humans, you know, the human to human, there's little subtle differences on the surface of the organ, and the recipient's immune system notices that. And so we've spent the last, I would say, 15 years figuring out what those things are and which are the most important one. So Revivicor and eGenesis, which are the two companies in the United States, and Clone Organ, which is a Chinese firm, are all making their genetic donor pigs in the same way. It's kind of interesting. They take skin cells from adult pigs, so no pigs were harmed in the taking of the skin cells, and they disable about 4 genes that cause violent immune reactions in humans. Alpha-gal is one of them, And that's the one where the Western North Star tick, the Texas North Star tick, I think, is what it's called. If it bites a mammal and then bites you, you can become allergic to this protein that's on other mammals like pigs and cows. And you will get all sorts of joints and symptoms and rashes and GI symptoms when you eat meat because you're triggering an immune response. Well, they take that one out. They take a few other genes. They then insert about 6 or 7 human genes into this cell, if you will, get it into the nucleus. And then they remove the nuclei, which has all the DNA that's been CRISPRed, and they put it into pork ova that have had the nuclei removed. And it's just IVF from there. Once these eggs have started forming embryos, they're implanted into sows. And at the end, you get these gene-edited piglets. And there you are, the 10-edit pig. So we will be hearing, and I will keep you, as it comes out, I will keep you posted, because this is a transformational moment with xenografting, as it's called, where you graft from a different species. And yes, it's sort of a whole different kind of predation and animal husbandry. And there's all sorts of wonderful, interesting philosophical conversations that we could have about this. Also on the horizon is a new anti-rejection drug, which has supposedly fewer side effects than existing drugs. And there is a couple of other things on the horizon that I just want to throw in here. One of them is called this is like a product name. It's the euthymo kidney. And this is a pig kidney that has attached porcine thymus tissue. Now, the thymus is the gland that when you're born, it's just ginormous. It's like the size of your lung. And it's horizontally in your chest in front of your lungs. And what the thymus does is filter the blood and teach the immune system which proteins or which surface protein sugar molecules on the surface of cells it should not attack. So the thymus creates immune tolerance. And it does that. Turns out there's some microbiome is a little bit involved in this and well, but we don't really quite understand how that's happening. But the thymus is essentially a memory bank for what not to attack. And so what the firm scientists are hoping is that by putting the pig kidney with the thymus tissue, which is there to say, no, don't attack this, to the human immune system, they may be able to get better tolerance of the kidney. Well, that's certainly creative. There's also in the works an external pig liver perfusion system. So this would be a bridge to transplant, like the artificial heart that's outside of the body. This would be hooked up to a person's circulatory system. I guess it would be rather like peritoneal dialysis, where you essentially have a port and it's hooked up to your body maybe part of the time or at night when you sleep and cleans your blood. And maybe that could be done for kidneys as well. You could sort of have your dialysis pig and you just hooked up overnight. Who knows what they're going to come up with, but the idea that we are one step closer and maybe 5 steps away at this point to actually having a potentially unlimited organ supply for those who need transplants is extraordinary. And, you know, really looking at the current research, it's not at all far-fetched. Let's do female dogs are judging you. Female dogs remember when people exhibit incompetent behavior, but males don't seem to notice. Researchers recruited 30 dogs and put each one in a room with 2 strangers holding a clear plastic box. In clear view of the pup, but without ever looking at or interacting with it, the first person took the lid off the box with ease, while the second person struggled and failed. The two people then repeated the task, but this time the box contained a treat. The male dogs had no preference, between the competent and incompetent participants afterwards. But the female dogs ran over to the successful box opener 83% of the time. So this is after the treat's been taken out of the room. So this indicates female dogs can gauge a human's competence and adjust their behavior based on their evaluation. Well, I'm not sure about that quite yet, but they predicted that the competent person would therefore be able to open the baited container and get food. The reason for the gender divide remains unknown. The dog's age and neuter status had no impact. So basically, if a female dog sees you flailing, she's going to ignore you in favor of the person who managed to get that empty box open, especially now that it's got a treat. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.